This is Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3. And I wanted to let you know, you're going to hear two stories tonight. What a bonus. The Great Bell by Crispin Odubuck. And The Byzantine Omelette by Saki. So, I'll let you get settled, and I'll be right back with more Telling Tales with Ms. G here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. This is Ms. G. I'm back with Telling Tales here tonight at 104.3. The first story, The Great Bell, well, actually both stories, can be described as people who should just take a breath and listen to workers. The king of the short-sighted and stunted people, a wise old man acting on the wishes of his people, had ordered that a giant bell designed to strike hourly be built. The engineers of the land, laboring hard and long, have duly produced a bell, gigantic in all proportions, and it is now hoisted on a huge platform at the center of the country. The bell, however, fails to strike at the required times. To resolve this problem, the king calls a general assembly. "My people," the king begins when the people have gathered, "we greet you." "Great king of ours, we greet you," the people respond. "My loyal and beloved people, we greet you." "Great king, we greet you. We greet you, we greet you." His brow deeply creased, the king acknowledges the cheers of his subjects with grave nods and settles into his throne. "The great bell has been finished," he proclaims. "Yay," the people cheer. "Long live the king." But, he cautions, "the bell is not yet working properly." Well disposed to their king, the short-sighted and stunted people are quick in offering suggestions. "Set more engineers on it. Hire some foreign engineers." "No, consult the oracle." "Yes, consult the oracle." "That's it, the oracle." The cries go on and on until the old king raises his hand. "My loyal and beloved people," his majesty says, "we appreciate your concern and interest in our great bell. However, we doubt if this is a matter for the oracle. Besides, the engineers know what the problem is, but they have not been able to solve it. That is why we are gathered here today." The people can barely wait for his majesty to finish. "What is the problem? Why can't the engineers solve it? What sort of engineers are they? Fake ones? They shouldn't be paid. They should be caned. I say they should be hanged. Yes, hang them. Hang the engineers." The passionate, short-sighted, and stunted people rail on until the royal hand goes up again. "My loyal people," his majesty coaxes, "we doubt if this is a hanging matter. The engineers have done a great job. Why should we hang them for a problem they can't solve? Remember, they are a part of us, too. Indeed, we think they should be highly rewarded for their work." "Yes, I agree. Let's reward them. A cow with a bell for each." "Yes, one man, one cow." "Fair enough. One man, one cow." "No, a white bicycle is better." "But that is the king's official vehicle." "A black one, then. A black bicycle for each man." That's better. One man, one bicycle. Agreed. One man, one bicycle. But the great bell is not yet working properly. I wanted to say that. Well, now someone else has said it. The king smiles and strokes his curly gray beard as he muses over his subjects. One minute they want a hanging, the next they want to hand out rewards. He is still smiling as his hand goes up. My beloved people, we believe the first thing we should do is find out what the problem is. Why is the great bell not working properly? Yes, 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 the people agree. Why? The answer to that, His Majesty declares, can best be provided by the Chief of Engineers. Summon the Chief of Engineers. Let him come before us. People, His Majesty proclaims, and the arena quickly acquires a major attribute of cemeteries, the silence of the dead. My beloved people, His Majesty says, his voice softening, we give you the Chief of Engineers. He will tell you what is wrong with our great bell. A lanky, monocled man with wire-brush gray beard appears on the dais where the king sits with his entourage. He presses his monocle lightly as he executes a slight bow before the king. Then he whips a sheaf of papers out of his pocket. Great king, I salute you. With your kind permission, your majesty. The monarch now acknowledges the salutation and motions for the chief of engineers to proceed. The latter faces the people. Great people, I greet you. Chief of Engineers, we greet you. The problem with the great bell is that it fails to strike at hourly intervals as it has been designed to do. The short-sighted and stunted people, a great talkative lot, if there ever has been one, display their vaunted metal of the tongue. Did you hear that, man? Hey, you, don't we know that already? Did they say this man is the chief of engineers? I greatly fear for that great bell. Look, why won't the great bell strike at hourly intervals? Tell us why, not what. Speak, man, speak. He is speaking, but until you shut up, you will never hear him. You too shut up. After this, meet me at the well. You'll see yourself. Hey, you two, shut up. His Majesty's hand goes up. People, people, control yourselves. Chief of Engineers, please continue. The Chief of Engineers plunges in. The great bell won't strike because a big spring restrained the hammerhead. The people are incensed. Well, then, take the damn spring off. I can't believe my ears. This man should be caned, I say. Is this the Chief of Engineers? Incredible. I doubt if he can engineer a pot of soup. That will be too much for him. Can he engineer food into his stomach? I bet he couldn't engineer his wife into pregnancy. Oh, what a shame. Again, His Majesty's hand institutes silence. My beloved people, he teases, stop heaping abuse on the Chief of Engineers. Allow him to explain things to you. After all, he is the Chief of Engineers. The Chief of Engineers thanks His Majesty and directs a gaze of long-suffering at the people. The spring holding back the hammerhead cannot be removed because its removal will cause the hammerhead to fall and wreck the great bell. We cannot allow that to happen. It will be a grave calamity. So what is the solution? Comes a retort from the people. His Majesty gives a royal throat clearing. My beloved people, it is you who must offer suggestions to be considered by the engineers. Elated at the chance to show their problem-solving prowess, the short-sighted and stunted people fall over themselves. Put a screw through the hammerhead to hold it in place, then remove the spring. Nonsense! Add more steel to the hammerhead to... Rubbish! Place the hammerhead in a vice-like grip so... You're dumb. That hammerhead is not strong enough. And you need to hang a bell around your neck so people will know a cow is coming. The hammerhead is not the problem. The problem is the spring. Are you the only one here? Please let me say something. No, it's my turn. It's mine. Mine, I say. The wise old king raises his hand. People, people, control yourselves. Everyone shall have a say. But let's first hear what the chief of engineers think of the ideas we have heard so far. The chief of engineers, looking up briefly from the paper he has been busy scribbling in, clears his throat. Thank you, Your Majesty. We can't put a string through the hammerhead because it will cease to be movable, and we can't compromise that. Adding more steel will totally destroy the design function of the hammerhead. A vise just won't work. We already tried. I should add that the hammerhead is strong enough, so that isn't the problem. Finally, removing the spring, as I have already explained, is not an option. Thank you, Chief of Engineers, His Majesty says. Now we will hear more suggestions. We urge you to be orderly and respectful. Chastened by the king's words, the people are momentarily shy, but they are not known for being able to keep mum. Perhaps we should redesign the Great Bell. I disagree. A bracket is what's needed. What bracket is he talking about? Search me, I have no idea. Perhaps we should use another spring to counter the action of the first spring. I wanted to say that. Spare us, please. You always wanted to say that. A spring might work, but it would have to be a stronger spring, a more taut spring. Yes, make for us another spring. Indeed, set a spring to tame a spring. Up goes the king's hand again. He motions to the chief of engineers to comment on the spring issue. Thank you, Your Majesty. The chief of engineers begins, scratching his eagle head. I must confess that we did think of another spring initially, but we discarded the idea because it's a likely two-edged sword. It may work, but it may also fail, causing a design non-performance and possible malfunction that could lead to the destruction of the Great Bell. In fact, the original design called for a reversing spring, but we abandoned it because of the inherent danger. But there's a good chance it might work, not so? Someone queries from the front ranks. Yes, says the chief of engineers, there is a good chance. Indeed, synchronizing the clock flywheel with the hammerhead and bell mechanism, it will be much easier than with a second spring, but it will involve very extensive calculations to establish a reasonable margin of safety. This is because the addition of a second spring will automatically draw us closer to the threshold of unacceptable uncertainty. What that means is that we may succeed in activating the bell mechanism to function as per its original design concept, but we would also unwittingly trigger a disparity in displacement caused by centrifugal forces that can only be corrected, as I said earlier, by extensive calculations. The slightest error could be very dangerous. Empirical equations to aid the safety factor must be deduced through elaborate configurations aimed at establishing the right degree of tautness and the spring's potential displacement under the prevalent centrifugal forces acting on... Please, please spare us. Ah, my head is getting heavy. Is he speaking English? I doubt it very much. I thought my hearing had gone bad. You engineers should work out all the calculations you need to work out. Yes, we only want to hear the Great Bell toll at every hour to the proper count. Good talk. Good talk. But, the chief of engineers strains to be heard, but the safety margin is so miserably low that the slightest damn your safety margin. Aren't you the chief of engineers? I wonder. Go deal with your safety margin. Make for us a spring. Oh, yes, a spring. A spring is the best check for a spring. We want a spring. We must have a spring. A spring, then, comes the concluding remark of His Majesty, throwing his royal weight behind his people. And so the engineers do their calculations, worrying crazily over safety factors. Eventually, they build the spring and install it. The king then sets a date to unveil the Great Bell. On the appointed day, the entire country gathers at the center of the country under the Great Bell. My loyal people, we greet you. His Majesty begins the greeting protocol. Prayers and exhortations that the Great Bell may bring fortune and fame to the land soon follow. The king then delivers his speech. My truly loyal and dearly beloved people, he declares in royal tones, it is with great joy that we welcome you to this historic unveiling ceremony of our Great Bell. The people clap and cheer. His Majesty, holding firm to his royal tone, carries on. During the course of the year, we have all labored greatly to build this great bell. With its completion, the great bell shall serve eternally as a testimony of our greatness in purpose and unity. Our great engineers who designed and executed this great bell have done us all a great service. They are our great pride. As such, it is with great happiness that we announce the royal gift of a great cowl with a bell to each member of the design and building team. Yay, the people cry, clapping and stamping their feet. In addition, the king continues, they shall also receive a black three-speed bicycle. Yay, the people cheer again. And since we all had a hand in this monumental endeavor, the king rides on, we shall not only wine and dine together at our great palace after this, there will be great gifts of all sorts for everyone. Yay, the people scream. With this great endeavor, His Majesty, now really in his royal element, continues, we announce our coming of age to the world. Henceforth, we shall be known as all a great people, led by a great king, and achievers of great things. Yay, the people roar. Therefore, the great king pauses for a great royal effect, as I pull this lever, that we might all enjoy the first tones from our great bell, I urge you to raise a mighty shout to our greatness. His Majesty duly pulls the lever. Bang! The great bell tolls. Yay! The people thunder. Crack! Cracker crack! Crash! Twang! Yakata! Split! Gavoy! Woom! Gavish! Poof! Oh, ah, oh no, oh my God, what, oh my, help, please. From the land beyond the cliffs, deep in the hinterland, comes word of the total demise of the momentarily great short-sighted and stunted people on the day of their great achievement. The end. You've just heard me read The Great Bell by Chris Ben Odubak. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G. I hope you enjoyed that story. And I have another one coming up in just a bit. I'll let you get more settled. Thank you. This is Ms. G. I'm back with another story. Yeah, about listening to your workers. This is called The Byzantine Omelette by Saki. Sophie Chattel Monkheim was a socialist by conviction and a Chattel Monkheim by marriage. The particular member of that wealthy family whom she had married was rich, even as his relatives counted riches. Sophie had very advanced and decided views as to the distribution of money. It was a pleasing and fortunate circumstance that she also had the money. When she inveighed eloquently against the evils of capitalism at drawing room meetings and Fabian conferences, she was conscious of a comfortable feeling that the system, with all its inequalities and iniquities, would probably last her time. It is one of the consolations of middle-aged reformers that the good they inculcate must live after them if it is to live at all. On a certain spring evening, somewhere towards the dinner hour, Sophie sat tranquilly between her mirror and her maid, undergoing the process of having her hair built into an elaborate reflection of the prevailing fashion. She was hedged round with a great piece, the piece of one who has attained a desired end with much effort and perseverance, and who has found it still eminently desirable in its attainment. The Duke of Syria had consented to come beneath her roof as a guest, was even now installed beneath her roof, and would shortly be sitting at her dining table. As a good socialist, Sophie disapproved of social distinctions and derided the idea of a princely caste. But if there were to be these artificial gradations of rank and dignity, she was pleased and anxious to have an exalted specimen of an exalted order included in her house party. She was broad-minded enough to love the sinner while hating the sin. Not that she entertained any warm feeling of personal affection for the Duke of Syria, who was a comparative stranger, but still, as Duke of Syria, he was very, very welcome beneath her roof. She could not have explained why, but no one was likely to ask her for an explanation, and most hostesses envied her. "You must surpass yourself tonight, Richardson," she said complacently to her maid. "I must be looking my very best. We must all surpass ourselves." The maid said nothing, but from the concentrated look in her eyes and the deft play of her fingers, it was evident that she was beset with the ambition to surpass herself. A knock came at the door, a quiet but peremptory knock, as of someone who would not be denied. "Go and see who it is," said Sophie. "It may be something about the wine." Richardson held a hurried conference with an invisible messenger at the door. When she returned, there was noticeable a curious listlessness in place of her hitherto alert manner. "What is it?" asked Sophie. "The household servants have downed tools, madame," said Richardson. "Downed tools?" exclaimed Sophie. "Do you mean to say they've gone on strike?" "Yes, madame," said Richardson, adding the information. "It's Gaspard that the trouble is about." "Gaspard?" said Sophie wonderingly. "The emergency chef, the omelet specialist?" "Yes, madame. Before he became an omelet specialist, he was a valet, and he was the one of the strike breakers in the great strike at Lord Grimford's 2 years ago. As soon as the household staff here learned that you had engaged him, they resolved to down tools as a protest. They haven't got any grievance against you personally, but they demand that Gaspard should be immediately dismissed." "But," protested Sophie, "he is the only man in England who understands how to make a Byzantine omelette. I engaged him specially for the Duke of Syria's visit, and it would be impossible to replace him at short notice. I should have to send to Paris, and the Duke loves Byzantine omelets. It was the one thing we talked about coming from the station." "He was one of the strike breakers at Lord Grimford's," reiterated Richardson. "This is too awful," said Sophie. "A strike of servants at a moment like this, with the Duke of Syria staying in the house. Something must be done immediately. Quick, finish my hair, and I'll go see what I can do to bring them around." "I can't finish your hair, madam," said Richardson quietly, but with immense decision. "I belong to the union, and I can't do another half minute's work till the strike is settled. I'm sorry to be disobliging." "But this is inhuman," exclaimed Sophie tragically. "I've always been a model mistress, and I've refused to employ any but union servants, and this is the result. I can't finish my hair myself. I don't know how to. What am I to do?" It's wicked. Wicked is the word, said Richardson. I'm a good conservative, and I have no patience with this socialist foolery, asking your pardon. It's tyranny, that's what it is, all along the line. But I've my living to make, same as other people, and I've got to belong to the union. I couldn't touch another hairpin without a strike permit. Not if you was to double my wages. The door burst open, and Catherine Maltham raged into the room. Here's a nice affair, she screamed. A strike of household servants without a moment's warning, and I'm left like this. I can't appear in public in this condition. After a very hasty scrutiny, Sophie assured her that she could not. Have they all struck? She asked her maid. Not the kitchen staff, said Richardson. They belong to a different union. Dinner, at least, will be assured, said Sophie. That is something to be thankful for. Dinner? Snorted Catherine. What on earth is the good of dinner when none of us will be able to appear at it? Look at your hair and look at me. Or rather, don't. I know it's difficult to manage without a maid. Can't your husband be of any help to you? Asked Sophie despairingly. Henry, he's in worse case than any of us. His man is the only person who really understands that ridiculous newfangled Turkish bath that he insists on taking with him everywhere. Surely he could do without a Turkish bath for one evening, said Sophie. I can't appear without hair, but a Turkish bath is a luxury. My good woman, said Catherine, speaking with a fearful intensity, Henry was in the bath when the strike started. In it, do you understand? He's there now. Can he get out? He doesn't know how to. Every time he pulls the lever marked release, he only releases hot steam. There are two kinds of steam in the bath, bearable and scarcely bearable. He has released them both. By this time, I'm probably a widow. I simply can't send Gaspar away, wailed Sophie. I should never be able to secure another omelet specialist. Any difficulty that I may experience securing another husband is, of course, a trifle beneath anyone's consideration, said Catherine bitterly. Sophie capitulated. Go, she said to Richardson, and tell the strike committee or whoever are directing this affair that Gaspar is herewith dismissed, and ask Gaspar to see me presently in the library, when I will pay him what is due to him and make what excuses I can, and then fly back and finish my hair. Some half an hour later, Sophie marshaled her guests in the grand salon preparatory to the formal march to the dining room, except that Henry Maltham was of the ripe raspberry tint that one sometimes sees at private theatricals representing the human complexion. There was little outward sign among them, those assembled, of the crisis that had just been encountered and surmounted. But the tension had been too stupefying while it lasted not to leave some mental effects behind it. Sophie talked at random to her illustrious guest and found her eyes straying with increasing frequency towards the great doors through which would presently come the blessed announcement that dinner was served. Now and again she glanced mirrorward at the reflection of her wonderfully coiffed hair, as an insurance underwriter might gaze thankfully at an overdue vessel that had ridden safely into harbor in the wake of a devastating hurricane. Then the doors opened and the welcome figure of the butler entered the room, but he made no general announcement of a banquet in readiness, and the doors closed behind him. His message was for Sophie alone. "There is no dinner, madam," he said gravely. "The kitchen staff have downed tools. Gaspar belongs to the union of cooks and kitchen employees, and as soon as they heard of his summary dismissal at a moment's notice, they struck work. They demand his instant reinstatement and an apology to the union. I may add, madam, that they are very firm. I've been obliged even to hand back the dinner rolls that were already on the table." After the lapse of 18 months, Sophie Chattel Mockheim is beginning to go about again among her old haunts and associates, but she still has to be very careful. The doctors will not let her attend anything at all exciting, such as a drawing room meeting or a Fabian conference. It is doubtful, indeed, whether she wants to. You've just been listening to me read The Byzantine Omelet by Saki. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G. I hope you enjoyed tonight's stories. Until next time, good night.